Welcome to It's More Than That.
I'm thinking very, very intentionally about what I can do to make a difference with the time that I have left. I want to run, you know, into the finish line on fire.
It's More Than That is a podcast by the University of Minnesota Duluth. I'm Paula Peterson. Often we don't understand the full story of someone's reality. Join me as we explore the complexities of the human experience. This week on the show, Helen Mongan-Rallis. All right, I would love to welcome to the studio my friend and colleague, Dr. Helen Mongan-Rallis, who is associate professor in the Department of Education, right?
Correct.
Right, Helen?
Yes.
Thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, Helen, you and I go way, way back. 30 years?
We do.
Yes.
We do.
Yeah. Helen, just for our listening audience, I've been fantasizing about having Helen on this show since it started. Just knowing your story, Helen, and all that you've done to work with faculty and staff and on inclusive pedagogy and goal 2. And so just very excited to have you here.
It's an honor to be here. Listening to the ones that have gone before, I feel very humble that I get to talk along with an amazing cast of people that you've had.
Yeah, it's been really powerful to hear people's stories.
Mm.
So
so
it's your turn.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as you know, as a listener, we like to start with just hearing a little bit about you, your story, where you come from, where you're rooted, and how you ended up here.
Okay.
30 years ago.
And you have how many hours?
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you say, where am I rooted? Because I'm from South Africa. And when I'm here in Duluth in the United States, and I talk about home, I mean South Africa. Mm. I left South Africa in 1984, but I am deeply South African, an African to my core, and that is my home. But what is interesting is when I get off the plane in Johannesburg and I'm there and I talk about home, I mean Duluth, Minnesota. So, you know, sort of bicultural, and I feel torn. And in many ways, actually feel, although I feel South African and feel Minnesotan, I still, after all these years, often feel neither when I'm treated as neither. Mm. So my South African friends think I'm American, and my American friends think I'm South African. Mm. And so that's that statelessness that is sometimes feels a little homeless.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you used the word bicultural. I mean, I think that's maybe not an uncommon experience for folks with bicultural identities.
Yes.
A foot in two doors.
Yes.
Or two worlds.
And I'm cautious about using that.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, sometimes people, sort of an American thing is that you have these sort of list of identities, you know, Asian American, African American, da da da, and so what am I? And I suppose if I have to be, I'm Asian, European, African American, but I almost never like to say that, because the moment I even use African American as part of my identity, I think it minimizes the experiences of people of color. Although I am born in Africa and I'm deeply African, I'm white with all the privilege that comes with being an unearned privilege of being white. So I don't, you know, I'm sort of have multiple identities. I'm rooted in place, but also rooted in many other aspects of my identity. But no matter how many identities I have, excuse me, the fact that I'm white, both in South Africa still, even after the end of apartheid, and here in the United States, it trumps all. And that's something that's been part of my journey. And even in It's More Than That, is very powerful, that realization of how profoundly important that is and how I navigate the world.
Yeah. Well, and I'd love to have you talk, if you're willing, more about growing up white in apartheid South Africa.
Yes.
It's a powerful story.
Yeah. So I was born the day before the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa. So I was born in a country deeply steeped in racial turmoil and in growing anger against the oppressive white regime that the apartheid government came to power in 1948. I was born in 1960. Growing up as a white person in a highly segregated society, people think here in the States of, you know, apartheid is sort of like Jim Crow, and it's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. It's the system of apartheid was not only segregation by place, but also by your role in society, by school, by who could be where. And so white people in South Africa growing up completely, you could choose to be completely oblivious mm-hmm. of the incredible privilege of being white. So I grew up in an all-white neighborhood, went to an all-white school, was surrounded by white people in privilege, and the black people I know were people who were servants. Mm-hmm. And our relationship with black people was only in that way. And even as a young child, people raised to sort of see themselves as superior to black people, you know, even little children seeing the way they talk to domestic workers. My father was a university professor, my mother was a librarian, and I was born on a university campus, I'm in a hospital, mm-hmm. and so grew up in a very liberal environment. And my parents, as for many, most white South African families, had a domestic worker, Maria Kumalo, who lived with us. Mm-hmm. And she's a huge, hugely important part of my story.
Yeah.
Because Maria was like another mother to me, and I call her my other mother. And she helped raise me. And when I came to the States, people said to me, you know, how come as a white South African was I so opposed to apartheid, and do I feel so passionate about anti-racist work? And I used to say, when I first came here, you know, my thinking was, my parents raised me to respect everyone. They didn't draw a color line.
Mm-hmm.
And then my growing realization was that it was actually much simpler than that. I loved Maria.
Hmm. Yeah.
And to grow up loving a person of color, a black woman, you know, especially in South Africa, and with the naivety of a child that I loved her mm-hmm. and accepted her. And from very, very young, started to be aware of how she was treated differently as a black person. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is when I was, you know, way before I went to school even. And it used to make me really, really angry. And so I was, you know, I think I was born outspoken. But one of my memories in South Africa, my all-white school with all-white teachers, we had the principal of the school that I was at, the elementary school, was, I think she was a supporter of the apartheid regime. She was an Afrikaans woman. Afrikaners were typically, but of course not always, supporters of the National Party, the apartheid government. I don't know if she was, but certainly her actions would suggest it. And one of my memories, we were standing in the circle outside the school, turning circle cars because we were picked up by our parents. There was no busing. And there was a water faucet, a tap in the middle of the circle. And our principal was there sort of supervising the children being picked up. And one of the girls, it was an all-girls school, one of the girls went over to the tap to have a drink. And our principal said, don't drink from the tap. The natives drink from it. Natives being black people. And I remember being absolutely just furious beyond measure.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a tyrant. I mean, she used to beat you if you were, you know, she used to hit you with a ruler over your knuckles. Mm-hmm. And people were terrified of her. I was terrified of her. But I just looked at her and I walked over to the tap and I took a long drink.
Mm.
And I think that was my first act of sort of political defiance and saying, don't you dare.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, she didn't dare. She didn't say anything. She just looked at me.
Mm.
You know, and then later on realizing, of course, how absolutely trivial that sounds to people of color. Shame, this poor little white girl took a drink from a tap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet in that time and context, Helen, it was so
powerful. And the, you know, I so that was in third grade. Mm-hmm. And I also worked in my first general election then. I was a runner for the Progressive Party. And I didn't know what my parents' political views were. Neither did my brother. But we both were involved in politics from very early on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up being called a kafir puti. And kafir is a extremely derogatory term in South Africa, the equivalent of the N-word here. Mm-hmm. And that, and puti means brother. And my white friends, you know, when they'd be saying things that were racist, or and I came, they'd say, stop talking, Helen's here. Mm-hmm. So very young, I got a reputation of sort of, they shouldn't talk about politics in front of me because I'd get angry. Mm-hmm. So sort of speaking out against injustice. And it was about Maria and just seeing how can you treat people like that? And you know, reading the new, the under the apartheid government, there, as I said, there's so many layers to apartheid, but one of them was, of course, censorship of the press. The press was controlled by the government. There was no television when I was growing up, so it was the radio and the newspapers. And I'd sit, and Maria be cooking in the kitchen, and I'd sit there with her, and I'd be reading the paper, and I just used to get so angry at the reporting, even in the censored press of. The what was being, what's happening to black people. And, you know, reading, one of the things that I remember reading, sort of reports of an accident where they talked about how many people were killed. There were five mm-hmm. people killed and four blacks, mm-hmm. as if they were not even people. And that treatment of black people white children indoctrinated, actually, mm-hmm. into seeing themselves as superior. And even the way the education system was, that in South Africa, you don't talk about people of color, because there's black people who are black indigenous people. South Africa, there's also colored people who descended from the Khoisan people, but people of mixed race, mm-hmm. which was illegal. As we know from Trevor Lowe, no, mm-hmm. he was sort of born a crime, because it was illegal for a black person, well, actually for people of different races to have sex. Mm-hmm. It was the Immorality Act was actually that. And so, but people, colored people, and colored people's home language is Afrikaans, which is interesting, because that's the language of the oppressor, of the mm-hmm. the apartheid regime. And then Indian people from India, Indian people were brought over as indentured servants on the sugar plantations, and then white people. And so the society was racist, but not just black-white, but sort of if it was a hierarchy with whites on top, actually white men on top. Mm-hmm. And then women, and then Indian men, Indian women, colored men, colored women, black men, black women.
Okay.
So it was very much like that. And schools were segregated by race, except white, colored, Asian, they're called Asian, and black schools. And so the schools for black people were called, the education for black people was called education for subservience. Hmm. Black children went to school to learn to become servants. And so they were indoctrinated from a very early age, and that is their role. And because black people lived in separate residential areas outside of white cities, they were not allowed to live in the city. And even black families were not allowed to live together. And the past laws in South Africa required that black people always carry a pass, and mm-hmm. in order to have a pass to allow you to live in a city, people had to have lived and worked for the same employer for, I forget exactly the day, I think 10 years now, or for different employers, maybe mm-hmm. it was 15 years, I forget. But anyway, basically, if a black couple, man and woman, in those days they were only allowed to be a man and a woman mm-hmm. couple, came to a city, they were not allowed to live together. The man would usually work in the mines or the industries, and the women would often be employed as domestic workers, and they would have to live separately. And if a man should come and try and spend the night with his wife in her servants' quarters in the back of their white employers, the police would raid at 3-4 in the morning and arrest them. And so, if coming back to sort of how people were raised to not know any different. So they were segregated. They were put away, you know, in townships outside of the city if they were allowed to live in the city. Otherwise, in dormitories and in back servants' quarters. And so with little access to news that told them that this was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember another profoundly shaping experience for me, and actually the reason I became a teacher. I was talking to Maria, sitting in the kitchen.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Just this knowing in you and your relationship with Maria, and did you talk about it?
Yeah. And I used to talk about it, and she just listened.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her one day, you know, I think I was probably about 12, I don't know. I said to her, why don't you get angry? I was reading one of those disgusting articles in the newspaper again. And I said, how come you don't get angry? And of course now, it's just like, well, she didn't show her anger, but how come you don't get mm-hmm. angry? And she was just such a serene, amazing woman. She held up her hand. She pointed to her middle finger, the tallest finger, and she said, some people are born up here. And then she pointed to her little finger. And she said, and some people are born down here, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, and again, in my naive, white, privileged way, outraged.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, how can people believe that? You know, you can be anything you want to be, which, of course, is just an absurd thing for a, you know, white person to say, because, of course, they couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and as is true in this country still. If you're a person of color, there's so many systemic issues. But I realized then that so much of it had to do with how she'd been raised.
Mm-hmm.
How going through a system of education, she only received she went as high as third grade. She'd been indoctrinated to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
My parents sent my brother and I to private schools. They couldn't afford to send us to private schools on a professor and a librarian salary. But private schools in South Africa were not subject to the same indoctrination laws as the public school called government schools. They still had to teach, be taught a sort of government curriculum, but there was more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so my parents wanted to do everything that they could to enable my brother and I not to be brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they put all their life savings and everything, all their money into our education. They also, I think, saw the writing on the wall very early that what they could leave us was our education. And they actually said to us, your inheritance is your education. There will not be any money.
Mm-hmm.
Because we, and which was very, their vision was important because my brother and I both left as sort of political exiles. And we left with our suitcase. Well, our suitcase. Mm-hmm. I had to pretend I was going on vacation. We both did.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't take anything with you. I think we were allowed to take, I can't remember, it was $3,000 or $6,000, but that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left. But so for me, what I wanted to do is I wanted to become a teacher who could teach children to believe in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And realizing, you know, my part of my philosophy of education is the Starfish poem. And I don't know it exactly, but the story, mm-hmm. I should know it verbatim, of course, but about a man who's walking along, there's a little boy on a beach, and he's mm-hmm. picking up starfish who've been washed up and dead and dying and throwing them back. And the man says, why are you throwing back the starfish? What difference does it make when there's so many lying dead and dying? And the little boy looked at the starfish in his hand and he said, it makes a difference to this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, to even this morning in conversation mm-hmm. I've had, is what drives me with absolute conviction and passion. Is that it, and that's the, you know, it's more than that. It has to be, some people can do big things, the big picture. But for me, my realization early on is where I can make a difference mm-hmm. is one student at a time, one person at a time.
And yet, Helen, you do also. I've seen you, I've watched you work to change systems and structures. So, you know, you're throwing the one starfish back, and
yes.
you're also looking at what can we do so that there's not so many washed up on the shore.
Right,
and so I think that's, you know, we've been talking a lot about on this show about those different layers
yes,
and appreciate your work on both. And I know talking about Maria and growing up is a tender and painful thing for you to do. And so thanks for...
So you brought tissues, which was good because you know me.
I did. And I, it was such a privilege to go home with you, I don't know how many years ago, and meet Maria. She was retired at the time, and meet her family and stay with her in Zulu Natal. And clearly her love for you was, I mean, it was very much a mutual... love.
Yes, she was my mother.
Yeah.
So. Even when she died, you know, I as soon as I heard, I was on the plane within hours to go back and to her funeral in KwaZulu-Natal, and I was the only white person there, and her family waited for me to close the coffin, and only in Zulu culture, only the family sees sits with the body, and they waited for me.
Mm-hmm. So her family knew you were family
Yes,
to her.
You know, and I that's one of my, it's also a huge, deep appreciation and incredible guilt too, is I think I had more, I mean, I know, I had more of her than her children did. Mm-hmm. She had two daughters, and her daughters treated me like a sister. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how they did that. I think if I was black, I don't, the depth of forgiveness is the word. I mean, I don't know, that graciousness in sharing me, because they did.
Yeah.
And
sharing Maria.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, she, it just, and again, I just think that was the way, I don't know that they questioned to hate me, to be angry with me.
Right.
But it's just that part of that, and you know, who I am today is profoundly, importantly affected by Maria.
Yeah.
And her whole philosophy of life.
Yeah, she was very joyful, as
she
I
was,
recall.
She
yeah.
was. Just,
yeah. And then she raised her grandchildren while her daughters were, I mean, that part of that skipping a generation model of
Well, and that's part of the apartheid
family.
Model is that if parents go to the cities in search of jobs, because under the apartheid system, black people were required to live in the homelands, like reservations here, which were 14% of the land area. Black people were 86% of the population. And mostly the poorest land, and the land not able to support them, which is part of the evil ingeniousness of apartheid, because if you can't live off the land, the only thing choice was for adults to then go to cities to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't take their children because they hadn't qualified for a family pass, in a sense. So they had to leave their children in the homelands, which is why Maria raising her grandson.
Mm-hmm.
Because his mom had to go to the city to work. And so many, for generations of black people, being raised by grandparents living in the rural areas, and while their parents living separately, working for white people in the cities. And so Maria's family was like that.
Yeah. So one of those almost family, quote, air quote, cultural patterns that really was a result of trauma and systemic oppression that sometimes gets passed down then as cultural and familial. Fascinating.
Yeah. And it's part of colonialism too.
Mm-hmm.
So South Africa had the most extreme form of apartheid, but certainly Zimbabwe did. But other colonial countries where that fragmentation of families and the separation of families because of people having to go to work. In South Africa, one of the things that forced black people also to, initially under the Group Areas Act and early days of the architects of apartheid, was to require black people to pay taxes. But if they were subsistence farmers, they couldn't pay taxes. So the only way they could pay taxes was to have to go and earn money to pay tax.
Yeah.
You know, so there's an evil ingenious about it. And so it's as you said, generation after generation, that trauma.
So you mentioned, Helen, coming to the U.S. political asylum, is yeah. that the word, but the term you used?
A political refugee.
Political refugee.
So the way it worked for me, I graduated, I always wanted to be a teacher, and mm-hmm. I started teaching. As a teacher, I was a white woman. I was required to teach in a white school. I was not allowed to teach in, there were no multiracial schools. I couldn't teach in a black children. And as a white teacher, you were required at that stage to join the South African Teachers Council for Whites in order to be allowed to teach. And part of joining the council was you had to agree to teach in a Christian national fashion. And by Christian, you had to agree to teach Christianity. At the time, I identified as Christian, but I still refused to impose my faith on students. And national, as in the national party, the apartheid line. Mm-hmm. And I refused it either. And not only did I refuse to do those, but I refused to join the council. And I was teaching in two schools, actually, at the time, a public school, government school. In the morning, I was a geography teacher, mm-hmm. and in the afternoon, a physical education teacher at a private school. And the principals of both schools turned a blind eye to me not being a member of the council. Mm-hmm. They just ignored, and they let me carry on teaching. Mm. But each year, I would get a letter from the government and saying, "We see you haven't joined the council." They'd even provide you with excuses.
Yeah,
a box that you had to check, and then you had to join. And I just joined draw my own box and say I won't join a racist organization and send it back. But it became quickly clear that I would either have to join the council or give up teaching or leave the country. Hmm. And my friends, black people said to me, go overseas. They say it's time. The struggle is, it's time for black people. Let us do the struggle here, and you go overseas and talk to white people. Mm. Especially, I was talking about going to the States, and when the States didn't want to impose sanctions because they said it would hurt black people, which is code, I think, for it'll also hurt. Yeah. You know, it's a whole nother line. But anyway, mm-hmm. black people said, go and tell them that we've suffered for so long for no reason, that we're prepared to suffer a little longer if it will end apartheid. Mm-hmm. And so that gave me the courage, the permission, whatever, to leave. But I had to, and also the other thing too is that the struggle was turning into an armed struggle, mm-hmm. Which was a source of huge just turmoil for me because I'm a pacifist, mm-hmm. and I'm white. I am reasonably sure if I'd not been white, I would not be a pacifist. Mm-hmm. But it was just devastating to see the violence that was happening, I absolutely supported the anti-apartheid movement, but I was reluctant to support Mkhonto Sizwe, the Spear of the Nation, which was the militant wing, mm-hmm. and felt so torn. So I left, and so I came to the United States, I had to say my principals both had to write a letter to the government assuring them that I would be coming back, mm-hmm. and I can say this now because the principals of the schools are now dead, so they can't be victimized for this. But they actually compromised themselves by assuring that I would be back when they both knew that I would absolutely not. And so because of that, then I was given a visa to leave the country. I had to buy a round-trip ticket and pretend that I was coming back.
And you knew you weren't?
No.
Yeah.
And so the way I got in initially was to apply to study. Mm-hmm. So I did my... I went to the University of Miami in Coral Gables, mm-hmm. and did my master's, and then went to Penn State. And my job interview at UMD was my first job.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
So that was 1984 that you left.
I left 1984. Wow. 1989 is when I started here.
Okay.
So I did my master's in a year. Actually, I did my master's in a year, but then I went back to South Africa to write my thesis. Mm. And I did my master's thesis in geography on the effect of apartheid on squatters. Hmm. People living in informal settlements in South Africa, and then came back to the States and did my PhD at Penn State.
So there wasn't risk at the time of you not being able to return to the U.S. if you went back to write that thesis?
No, because I still had a student visa.
Okay.
I had not graduated. Okay. The moment I came back to the States, I stayed here for 5 years because I wanted to go home as often as I can.
Yeah.
But I didn't go home for 5 years until I became a permanent resident. I didn't dare go back.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
So then I came to UMD. So I applied for the job at UMD. When I applied for jobs, I wanted to be somewhere where there was wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
and so a job that I wanted to do. And yeah. UMD fit the bill, and I cancelled my other interviews.
Wow.
But
wow.
One of the things that brought me to UMD as well, with hindsight, I've always been, but I came out of the closet as a lesbian in 1984.
Okay.
Just before I left.
Just do it all in one year, Helen.
Just before I left. And then so, of course, I arrived as a lesbian and nobody ever knew me any other way. But at Penn State, I was subject to discrimination as a lesbian. And that's a whole other story. But part of it was when I applied for UMD, seeing the non-discrimination clause.
Mm.
And the basis of sexual orientation, and that was absolutely a factor in me choosing to come here. But even then, I was afraid to be out.
Sure.
And I remember when I first came, it was the Department of Instructional Science before education, and we were across the hall from the Women's Studies program, and they had a coffee room. And there was a coffee table and there was a journal on it and anyone could write in there. And I remember wandering in and just sort of exhaling. This was because there was no multicultural center then, and just sort of feeling home and still trying to discover what it meant to be a lesbian and a feminist, because I just never even thought about those things.
Yeah.
And the people writing their coming out stories, and they're mostly students in the journal, anonymous. And so I wrote in there and say, I'm a new faculty and I'd like to be out, but I'm afraid. Even though I think I talked about what happened at Penn State, and a student wrote back and said, please, if you can, come out of the closet. It would mean the world to students.
Wow.
Not only to LGBTQ students. They didn't talk about Q in those days.
Yeah.
But also to straight students, to have role models. And I realized that was really important. So I actually could remember, tell you the day I came out to my classes.
Really?
I mean, it was really scary, and I never actually had any backlash. Hmm. But now I have no idea. I mean, it makes it easier when you have a partner to be out, because you just talk about my partner, she.
Yeah.
And now with being married, it's...
Yeah.
So easy.
We're legal.
Yeah. It's a non-issue for me now, but it was a huge issue.
Sure.
You know, and I think about that even within the context of it's more than that. In the early days as a faculty member here, I was out and I was very much I spoke on panels, and I can't even remember anymore all the things. I knew we were involved in that, you know, and I'd be the token lesbian on the committee. And I was, you know, in leadership and in I forget what the organization was called then, for students and faculty and everything.
Yeah.
And I haven't been for a while, and it's not that I don't care, but it's more than that.
Yeah.
For me, in my own development, being lesbian and being feminist was sort of front and center, and sort of we're here, we're queer sort of stage. That pride stage was so important, and I think I played a role then.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's become much more than that. And my role, seeing that is just one of the forms of oppression, and becoming, as you said, you know, more involved in anti-racist work and intersection, in intercultural pedagogy. But I do a lot in my classrooms with my students.
Mm-hmm.
But my journey here at UMD is to become more involved in working with mentoring of faculty. And then one of the highlights of my career at UMD is with you on the intercultural leadership development, ILD, working with staff and faculty administrators from across campus. And then you and I have done the intercultural pedagogy community of practice.
Mm-hmm.
Has been just an absolutely deeply moving, profoundly important for me and my journey. And also seeing that that's a part I can play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has been powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had not heard that story about the anonymous journal. Mm. That's a powerful example of creating those opportunities for people to kind of ease their you know, put their toe in the water a bit.
Yes.
In terms of...
That was so wonderful. And to be, you know, be mentored by a student who became a friend.
Yeah.
And we still keep in touch on Facebook.
So you, even though it was anonymous in the journal, you eventually knew who each other were.
Yes. Yes, actually she came and lived with my partner and I. She rented a room for us and she was with us in the Halloween storm.
Whoa.
And I remember because her car got buried in the snow.
Okay.
I was thinking about her just this weekend in our storm.
We just had a big storm. We did. And I also just thinking back to you arriving in 1989, I started teaching in 1990 and love our story of finding one another as colleagues and eventually friends is parking in the quote faculty parking lot and always feeling the imposter syndrome of what am I doing here and do I belong and walking past your car, which always had toys on it. A kayak, a bike. I mean, it just, and I thought, who is this person who must be faculty because they're in the faculty lot who appears to have a life outside of this institution? And then we met at Instructional Development Service, which at the time was my lifeline in terms of, you know, you're hired to teach, but you knew how to teach, but the rest of us really didn't get anything in terms of what does it mean to teach, to educate. And so I just remember realizing that you were the person behind that car and being a serious role model for me, not only in teaching and pedagogy and inclusion, but how to maintain a sense of balance. I know we've lost it over the years at times, but just that there is more. There's a whole life, and fun and joy is an important part of our work. So
it is, and I
thank
think
you for that.
Yeah, and likewise, because I mean we've helped support each other, and you know come out and play. I remember you and I going kayaking. We snuck out of work one day because our teaching schedule allowed it.
Yeah.
And we went kayaking on the bay at Lake Superior. And we were so busy talking, we didn't notice that the...
Right.
But it wasn't Lake Superior, the bay, in the harbor. And the wind shifted and we got trapped in the ice.
What were we doing in kayak? That was like December or something.
I don't know, but we went kayaking because we love kayaking.
Right.
And so you went off, and I got washed up on a big ice slab and you went off to get the Coast Guard who didn't notice you, but we were so afraid that we'd be on the front page of the paper about these two professors playing hooky kayaking and getting trapped. But I think you're right, sense of play is important, and I think, you know, one of the things that is I think about you when sort of talking about this interview is sort of a saying in life, and one of the sayings that I got developed in just after I'd got tenure, when I just was, I'd sort of pushed myself to always try and do my best at everything, and still playing, but just not, there were not enough hours in the day, and sort of fell apart, and came back anything that's worth doing is worth doing badly, is my philosophy of life, which of course people shudder at that. And it's sort of tongue in cheek, because it's not about advocating doing badly, but it's about stop worrying about doing well as a place to start. That if you can just jump in with glorious abandon and say, if it's bad, at least you've started.
Yeah.
And you can, then there's something to work on and to learn from mistakes. And that has helped me in all sorts of ways, in all the work I do, whether it's to do with the work in social justice and in my classroom and also working with my students, because that fear of failure is devastating. And just as I get older, becoming more playful.
Yeah.
You know, my last class of the semester yesterday, I said to, and I do it periodically, and I hadn't done it for a while. And I said to the students, I said, I need three spotters And so they all kind of looked very bemused. and I said, I was encouraging them to go forth as teachers and take risks and do mm-hmm. silly things and learn from them and not be afraid to make a fool of yourself. And I did a headstand on the table yeah. again. And I still can. I'm 59 wow. and I did my headstand wow, wow. yesterday.
Great. You do that every semester, right?
Well, I have. I forgot. Yeah. Actually, last semester I had a neck injury.
Oh, so that's
I couldn't.
Right.
But I tried to do yeah. it. And I always sort of joke, I say, when I can't do a headstand on the table anymore, it's time to retire. But it is, it's a metaphor, I think. What I don't say is I was a gymnast, so actually doing a headstand is not difficult. But at my age, I'm not sure when it'll be, but I hope that I'll do headstands for a long time, both literally and metaphorically.
Yeah, yeah.
And not knowing if I can do it. Mm-hmm. Because and if I can't, I've got spotters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about that in the work that we do, that I've done... the intercultural leadership development at your invitation and the courage to teach work and the intercultural pedagogy, it's because we have spotters.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's become more and more important, even in the conversation that I had with a dear friend, a colleague of color this morning, is that we have to be spotters. And as white people, realizing that the role that I have to play
mm-hmm.
In being an ally. And an ally is not something you get to call yourself. It's what we do.
Yeah, yeah.
And as white people, it's easy just to shut the door and go home and not be. But I want to be a spotter more and call myself and other white folks out on this. This is, as I look forward to the next leg of my career and my life,
yeah.
seeing that work is so profoundly yeah. important.
Well, and if you... don't mind circling back, because I was thinking about the do something even if it's not done well.
Anything case.
Yeah, anything. And certainly I remember as faculty, you facilitated technology camp.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, believe it or not, there was a time before, yes. I remember before email, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So learning to use technology mm-hmm. more, like computer technology yes. in the classroom. And that really helped me to start, because mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know where to start. Mm-hmm. And you were facilitating that. And that was like, well, do a bad web page then.
Yes.
Start with a bad one.
Yes.
I was like, really? I can do that? So helpful. And then I think of this work we do with social justice and anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more than that mm-hmm. in terms mm-hmm. of, on one hand... we're going to make mistakes,
mm-hmm.
and on another hand, the consequences of our mistakes
yes.
are so much bigger.
Yes,
and so how do we hold those?
Yes,
how do we hold those?
Yeah, and I think about the consequences, particularly in this day and age of social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to my students, I'm so grateful there was no social media when I was a student, because I did so many stupid things
mm-hmm.
that could have been captured on, now I would be captured. I'm sure, and I saw students as I was upside down on the desk yesterday with their cameras taking pictures of me.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So,
Didn't think of that.
And I'm not quite sure if my shirt dropped down or not. It's one of those things I thought, oh, well, there it is. It's part of me.
Okay, but, we'll check Facebook as yes, soon as we get off the
but
air.
But the
here.
Thing is that we do. Our mistakes, we make mistakes, and they can become so public. And it's so easy to rush to judgment about things that people did.
Mm-hmm.
And I did stupid things,
yeah,
absolutely stupid things. So how do we do that? And part of what I do in my teaching is I teach about digital citizenship and social media. I teach elementary teachers, and they say, what's social media got to do with elementary students? And I say, a lot.
Yeah.
I said, it's like you watch the movie in fifth grade about sex education, and I think the reasoning behind that is you watch before you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with, we've got to raise children in a different way, to be responsible, to bear the responsibility of that. Mm-hmm. Because the mistakes, it's good to make mistakes, but realize that there are consequences today that weren't there before.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm even thinking about the next step of it, which is mm-hmm. the consequences on our colleagues of color.
Yes.
Of
yes.
as I learn and grow and develop and make mistakes. Yes.
On whose backs?
On whose backs?
Yes.
And it's it's a current struggle. Yes. I know we both have, yes, just in terms of our pedagogy and our,
yes,
process of doing this work, mostly with white colleagues.
Yes.
To encourage folks, yes, to not be so afraid of making a mistake that they stay in their,
yes,
their little cubicles,
yes,
and yet also to be profoundly aware of on whose backs,
yes,
their learning and growth and development falls on, and that's just a tension,
yes,
that we hold.
And it is complicated, you know,
yeah,
that I was talking to my friend this morning and saying that it's why people, we can't just say we're sorry. It's that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we shouldn't do those things, but we do. But what do we do? It's a much more than saying sorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing something, and stepping up and calling each other out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have an uncomfortable conversation to have with someone.
Yeah.
And now, as I hope that person would with me.
Yeah. Right.
And it's to be able to do that in a way that helps people to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's actually how I got in, even with technology. I got into technology because my students said, you know, asked me how to do email. I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated technology, absolutely hated it, and I was afraid,
really,
of it. Yes, but I couldn't stand it. And I realized that what example was I setting my students?
Mm.
And I had started going to IDS, the Instructional, mm-hmm, Development Service, to improve my teaching and learning about technology. But all the technology workshops were taught by men,
mm,
white men. It wasn't their fault that they were teaching them, but I thought, what kind of example am I setting?
Mm.
Not only to women, but also to men and people of other genders, that, actually, I didn't even think about that in those days. I think I thought about men and women.
Yeah, yeah.
But that I'm not doing this, and that workshops and courses on technology are taught by men only. And so I thought, I have to step up.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to step up with my students to learn with them.
Mm-hmm.
And get over my fear. And then I did that for a while, and I thought, why am I teaching about technology? It's so trivial when there are much more important things to teach about in this climate. And the I wanted to be much more involved in social justice in my teaching. So I stepped out of that, and I taught a course called Teaching in a Diverse Society for a while,
mm-hmm,
and worked with mostly white students to teach us about how do we do more than say sorry, what do we do as teachers? And then I went back into technology because what I realized is it's all connected,
mm-hmm,
and that technology is not something that is separate,
yeah,
from teaching in a way that promotes social justice and intersectionality. But I have to teach students through the through technology how to make a difference in students' lives. And so I come back and I do it. I still teach Teaching in a Diverse Society, except it's now called Teaching with Technology.
Yeah, yeah.
And no matter what I teach,
yep,
it is exactly what you say about me as a white person talking to other white people, because most of our students are white, and teaching them, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
What do we do? Because and when we make mistakes, how do we fix it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how do we
work
continue
to fix it?
To,
yeah. How do we continue
and to knowing, grow and learn and ourselves,
yep,
which is another, you know, I think you're a powerful example of that as a senior faculty who continues to grow, not only in your teaching and pedagogy, but in yourself.
Mm.
And how do we encourage our colleagues to take that on?
Yes.
And the way that you integrate diverse perspectives into your course,
yes,
all your courses, is really where we need to go, and it's been a struggle.
Yeah. And especially, you know, I think about, for me, one of my growth areas is realizing, you know, I teach about this from my white privilege perspective, but in an environment where I'm very supported in my views and surrounded by people who frankly think a lot like me. And so part of my own journey, in fact, was, 14 years ago, I don't know how many years ago now,
mm-hmm,
I became a firefighter. And it's because, I mean, of course, I love doing just like adventures, but part of it for me was realizing, you know, talking to people who are in rural fire departments, how most of the people on their departments were very conservative,
mm-hmm,
And had very different views to, because I'm not very conservative. You know, I consider myself extremely liberal. But I surround myself with people like me. And I didn't, when I thought about my own growth area, and it's a role that I see and I have been taking, continue to take, is to try to reach out across the incredible divides in our society. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, it's not a theory. I need to understand people who are not like me. Mm-hmm. And so joining a department, and one of the things that was really humbling about that, and I think about in taking risks, I didn't have a clue. And it was so refreshing to leave campus where I was, a faculty we treated with a lot of respect and becoming more senior and feeling that at least people thought I knew what I was doing, to go to a place where I was absolutely the bottom of the pile, the newest kid on the block, didn't have a clue, and people didn't care what I did in my job.
Right, right.
And so
or what your doctorate degree is.
Exactly.
Right.
Absolutely.
Not helpful.
and so that for me, I think about that, and I draw many lessons from being a firefighter and a first responder now that helps me in terms of forcing myself to take risks. Mm-hmm. And also knowing to step back, that as a firefighter, realizing that I don't have the strength anymore to do the things that I used to. So when do we say, if I continue to do that, I'm actually going to endanger other people? Mm-hmm. That it is time for me to step back from that, to create the space for other people to fill that space, mm-hmm. so that I can, instead of being on the front line fighting the fire, that I'm further back. I'm maybe running the pumps on the engine now.
Yeah.
Because there are people who can do it better and who need to know when my wisdom is needed and when to hold my mouth shut, because it's not like that anymore. And so that's been, as I encourage people to become first responders, not literally, but in firefighters, and going, and don't be afraid to learn something new and to say, I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not to mention the trust, I imagine, that you need in order to work with a group of firefighters in an emergency.
Yes.
And as a lesbian,
I shook the whole department up when I went in.
I'm sure. And yet it sounds like you have trust and relationships in a way that you would go into a fire.
Absolutely.
Literally.
I mean, we have each other's lives.
Yeah.
And we hold each other's lives, and literally have each other's backs. When somebody's holding a hose, you have to have somebody behind them. You're leaning against them, holding their back. That because the force of the hose is so great that they don't get knocked over.
Yeah.
And knowing that they will do that for you, even though you will go into the polling booth, which is the fire station in the rural department.
Oh, really?
And vote separately.
Yeah.
And I remember my first fire, going to my first practice, and two of the firefighters were getting into this brawl. It was this woman and man yelling at each other. And I grew up, you don't yell at each other. Adults, I've never seen adults fight like that. And they were like cats. And it was a political thing. Mm-hmm. And the man said, because she was saying to him, she was giving, because he wasn't volunteering as an election, to help in the election. He said, I couldn't volunteer in the election because I wouldn't let those damn Democrats come anywhere near the building. And so I put my hand up. And he said, what? I said, can we come to the building for firefighter practice? I thought he was going to bite my head off, and then he laughed.
Yeah,
and he's become a dear friend.
Oh, yeah, wow.
And it's that that we're more than our political views.
Yeah,
and they're people who come. I come from a country, seeing the incredible devastation of guns against my country people, and so I'm just I go into a panic seeing a gun, and I'm terrified of them and everything. But they're people who carry guns to firefighter practice, and sitting down, talking to them one day and say, tell me about your guns. Tell me your story. And hearing their story, and I've had many conversations with them. We don't usually talk direct politics.
Yeah.
But getting to know their story and their complexity and the about who they are, and that has helped me enormously in my work and in my life.
Well, that's part of the idea of this podcast is to have these in-depth conversations where we can hear people's stories and the complexity and nuances and get the layers of it's more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you introduced in one of, because I I'm a polar groupie. Whatever you do, all these amazing initiatives that I've benefited from so much. And one of the sayings that you introduced is the quote from Rumi. And I'm not sure if I get it exactly right, but out somewhere out between wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. Mm-hmm. I'll meet you there.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I remember my sort of gay pride stage and my sort of, when I was young in South Africa, speaking out against apartheid and priding myself on the fact that I didn't have any friends who were members of the National Party, mm-hmm. which, you know, the support the apartheid party. And now looking back on that with shame, it's like, how can I be proud of not knowing people? I'm not making friends with people who are not like me. Mm-hmm. And so that it's the, and I used to be so much more judgmental. It's clearly wrong, what's clearly right. And I hope that I still have as burning a passion as ever for justice and social justice. But seeing that it's complicated and mm-hmm. it's not a binary, and that out between wrongdoing and right doing, it isn't that they're good people and bad people, and not, I don't mean to minimize it, but that there is, rather than seeing it as only two things, that to go and sit down in that field and listen, mm-hmm. and listen deeply to understand so that we can right the injustice. Not just to say everyone's right, because I don't think so.
Right, yeah.
But I think that when we're in the field, rather than facing off in anger, there's a different conversation. Mm-hmm.
And hopefully there's listening on both ends.
Yes.
I think that's part of the, for me, the impacts of some of, it's not just a football team and who wins and who loses. It's the impact of maybe your, quote, politics on lives.
Yes.
And it just makes it harder unless there's listening on both sides.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes, and what I would also say is that part of my journey, too, is knowing when the listening doesn't have to be on both sides. As a white person, when I just need to shut my mouth.
Yeah, yep.
And to listen, to be there, for my friends of color.
Yeah.
And know when to just, it's not about me, it's not about my white guilt, it's not about anything else, it's about listening. And even when I want to defend myself, shut my mouth and listen, because... So it's knowing when.
Right.
When to listen and when it needs to. And part of, I think of Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People from very long ago now. But he.
I thought it was five. Are there seven now? Okay.
that one of the messages says, seek first to understand and then to be understood. Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes I want to rush in my righteous anger to confront and everything. Mm-hmm. And instead, stepping back and essentially saying, tell me a story. And to listen. Because when you seek, what I've found is when I seek to understand people, even if I fundamentally disagree, but just listening, that if people feel listened to, they are then, it creates a space for them to be able to hear me. But if I want to be heard first... then that doesn't work. And I mean, I forget that in my own personal relationship. I think, you know, if my partner and I are having a disagreement and I want to be rushing and be right, if I had to remember that and just say, listen, stop, because there's a very valid reason, you know, that she's mad at me, and listen to understand. And so that and with you, with the Courage to Teach work, when you've taught us just about listening and listening, not to respond or to understand. You know, it's not even saying to people, help me understand, because it's not about me. But what do I need to ask questions so that they feel that they're listened to? Yeah. And I have massive relapses in doing that still.
Yeah, we all do.
But it's I keep remembering this, listen, but really listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if we could... talk a little bit about just some tips or ideas, thinking about faculty who are out there listening, who want to do more in their classroom, to be more inclusive, to be more intercultural, to include more diverse perspectives. Mm-hmm. Like what advice, tips can you share?
Well, I think about the work, the group we've had now, I don't even know how many years, going 4 years or so, the Intercultural Pedagogy Community of Practice, one of the things, a tip perhaps, is to share stories with each other. The teaching is not a solitary act. And that, especially when we've been teaching for a while, we sort of do things the way we've done them.
Teach the way we were taught.
Yes, teach the way we were taught.
That, yes.
And also that we found that works, and that works, at least we think it works. It works for most people. But the thing is, most people is not everybody. And that's, so a tip is that I give to students is you need to teach and do things in your classroom regularly that you would not like to have done unto you. So don't treat others as you would like to be treated. But part of it is trying to understand how other people would like to be treated, and sort of the platinum rule or whatever, treat them. But so if you teach in a way that you wouldn't like to learn, then you are probably reaching people who are not like you. So if you always teach, this would work, and I'd like to do this, well, then you're teaching people like you. And so being able to, being willing to step outside of your comfort zone and to take those risks, do headstands, but it's not... and so that as people are trying to be more inclusive and intercultural in their pedagogy, I think sometimes people think it's content, and that's part of it. But it's the how do we step outside of this binary, the policies that are made that advantage most, to say, how do I create a space that is a brave space for students to feel that they can step up? And so we need to go back and start with what we even do to connect with our students before we meet them. The email that we send saying welcome, and what we do the first day of class, which is not the syllabus, but it's about creating that environment where people feel that they matter. And so the advice is, have people feel that they matter. And if they feel that, then the content and the skills would come. But that first and foremost, and they have to matter no matter who they are, because we're in a hugely divided society and our classrooms are like that too. That people know that we're not always going to agree politically or anything else, but that who they are as an individual is important. And if we do that, if we can do that for our students, that to me is the foundation of intercultural work. It isn't, I say, I don't know much about this culture or that culture. It's about individuals and their story and how you can meet them in that field rather than saying a policy that it's either this or that. Does it have to be? Because people are afraid of setting a precedent. If I do this for this student, then, well, you know, then the floodgates, well, try. You'd be surprised. I don't, the floodgates have yet to open for me.
You know? There are so many times that you've challenged my thinking about things, Helen. And one of the examples that's coming to mind is at the point that internet became more accessible to students, and students were able to buy papers or plagiarize in big, profound ways. And there was software being developed to catch it. And you said at a group, well, it's a bad assignment then. If it's that easy to just go find it, then that's not a good assignment because it's already been done. So come up with an assignment that that cannot possibly be out there. I mean, just getting me to think about that, that's actually an adaptive strategy that is a useful skill for a student. I mean, if we go out into the world and that's the first thing we do is what else is out there before I recreate it?
Google it.
Yes. So it just, so many times you would say something like that where it would just flip my thinking upside down, which is when I feel most alive. I just love those. I never thought about it that way.
And that's why community is important.
You know,
that right. You need spotters, because I think it's scary. And you won't think about it that way if you don't have other people pointing out there's another way. But also when you do it, that you're doing it in a community. In our intercultural pedagogy group, I feel like family.
It does.
Because we challenge each other on those things, and we help each other see things differently. That, you know, we have other people, you and I, who do that for us.
Yeah, get outside of our boxes and our lenses and our ways.
Wow, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, that's a a helpful strategy. Is there anything else that you were excited to talk about that we haven't gotten to on this?
I don't think so.
I think one of the questions about it, what's your It's More Than That story, and I feel like you've shared a lot about about that, and if there's anything more that you want to put out there.
Well, I think about sort of, you know, I've talked about my own sort of It's More Than That. There's so many aspects to who I am and who the diversity is. And it's not diversity. It's about the intercultural work we do, social justice stuff. But that constantly looking for that and asking, you know, what more is there?
Yeah.
And as I look, I'm coming to the twilight of my career, looking retiring in the next few years, and very much not looking to what I'm going to do then, but leading up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
How do I exit here, UMD? I want to make, to run, you know, into the finish line on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Still doing headstands, but that I'm thinking very, very intentionally about what I can do to make a difference with the time that I have left.
Mm.
And that means stepping back. Part of it is it's stepping up in a different way.
Yeah.
Is how do I create the space so that when I leave, I am completely redundant, because I'm not needed anymore. There is so much more. And that I can use my wisdom as an elder, perhaps, to know when to speak and when to keep quiet, and how to create that space so that others step in without feeling like they have to do what I did.
Yeah.
In creating an empowering environment for people to step up and do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've always said the two reasons for me to retire, one when I can't do a headstand on the table, but the other is when I say it can't be done.
Hmm.
And when I find myself getting negative and sort of saying, well, you know, in my day, and we didn't, because that was my day, it's no longer my day. And so looking at things and thinking, it's not how I would do it, but they're not me and times are different.
Hmm.
And being really open to what is, helping when I am needed without being paternalistic.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that's I try to be so careful about.
Well, and it so requires us to set our ego aside.
Yes.
I think can be particularly difficult for academics, frankly, where the discipline, the profession tends to be a lot of ego involved. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, my discipline, I keep changing, reinventing myself every few years. I don't really...
She could
I'm not an expert if I do. I'm not an expert at anything. You know, it's that the... So I've had a lot... That's been a lot easier for me.
Yeah.
But I do think that being able to let go... I mean, one of the things is aging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting. I have an iPhone, and you can do Apple Pay. And so sometimes my phone doesn't recognize my face. And so when you're at the grocery store and you wave your phone at the thing and it doesn't recognize it, then you have to put your password in. Now, being a techie, I've got a very secure password. It's not a simple one.
Yeah.
And so it takes a while to type in. So I'm typing in, and often it's the young person at the cash register who's trying to tell me how to do Apple Pay and how to use my... Because they see this... I'm no longer a middle-aged woman. It's an older woman who they assume doesn't know how to use technology.
Yeah, wow.
And I, part of me, you know, my ego gets, I just want to say, I teach this stuff.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, I know how to do it. I just have a complex password. And apparently my face today is not what it was yesterday because it doesn't recognize me. But I recognize that.
You're on the other end of it.
Yeah. Mm. The part of me that's... the way I'm getting treated differently is because of my age.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I smack myself and say, oh, get back into your white privileged hole. Because I get to, you know,
yeah.
I think about, wow, what people have to go through every single day.
Yeah.
People of color, you can't just choose. And they felt, I mean, they've been treated badly because of how they look.
Yeah.
From birth.
Right. Right.
And now I'm getting old and oh, poor me. Yeah. Shut up. I get impatient with myself, which helps me to put my ego back in its hole.
Right.
It's like, wow, there is so much more than that, what I'm going through. And to realize that. Mm-hmm. That helps me come back and say, yep, I can do, there's something I can do.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Listeners on the show know that a gratitude has been a dozen eggs from our Icelandic chicken flock. And it's winter and they don't lay eggs right now. So I told David, I don't think we can record podcasts right now because I don't have eggs.
They don't have chickens in, I mean, Icelandic chickens should like winter, don't they?
They do, but they still, it's like us. They go through a period of rest and renewal and molting and mm-hmm. they sleep more like
and
I
lay less.
Want to do and lay less. Yes, no, yeah, they don't lay at all. And we don't give them artificial light. So anyway. Long story short, I want to bring something, and so I brought you a little tin of rusks, the recipe that your stepmom gave me when we were in South Africa. When was that? Was that 2000?
I don't even remember.
The first time?
I remember.
I did change the recipe a little bit, so you'll have to see if they're, but it, I stumbled upon, I've not made them before, Helen.
Oh, an absolute treasure. I love rusks. One of the things when I go home, that's what.
Yes.
You know, I look,
get some Five Roses tea.
Yes.
And have your, dunk your rusks in your tea. And
all good boys and girls is on the.
Yeah, it's a Christmas tin. That's all I had.
I want to show the microphone.
Yeah,
but you
right.
Can't
show
see
the
it.
Microphone, yeah. The Christmas tin.
Santa's
yeah,
holding
Santa's
a book
holding,
beaming.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's. Yeah. This is, as much as I love eggs, this is better.
Yeah.
And well, I'm it was, let the chickens rest.
It was fun to think of you and think of that, of Lucy and
yes.
Maria and your dad. And just thank you for sharing your life with me and with our listening audience.
Appreciate being here. Thank you for this is an amazing series.
Yeah.
Thanks. You're doing amazing work. Thank you.
Thanks. You can listen to more episodes of UMD's It's More Than That podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Visit d.umn.edu/campusclimate to find additional information on our episodes and more about what the University of Minnesota Duluth is doing to build a better, more welcoming campus community for all. And you can sign our pledge and work with us on your own personal journey.